Bill Neville with the Untrust Group, and Neil Bawa, who's going to be our speaker, my main presenter. And we've got a poll up there. We'd appreciate if you could answer that question. And all right, Neil, let's get started. Go ahead on to the first slide.
Okay.
So the Untrust Group, first of all, we need to specify that we are not an advisor or an investment sponsor or CPAs. We are custodians and record keepers of retirement accounts. So any information you present to you is for educational information only. And if you are considering investing based on anything you're seeing in this presentation, we encourage you to have a consultation with any advisors, CPAs, lawyers, anybody like that. But it won't be Entrust. So today's agenda, real quickly, I'm going to take about 5 minutes just to go over Entrust. Then I'm going to hand it over to Neil, who's going to do his really great presentation that he titled Disruptive Real Estate Trends. And then we're going to have a Q&A at the end. So feel free to type in your questions as you go along, and we're going to answer them all to you. Neil and I will both stay on. Any questions about self-directed IRA specifically, I'll answer, and pretty much everything else Neil's going to answer. That's me. I've been with the Entrust for actually April 1st. We'll be starting my 13th year. My role is to educate people on how they can use their retirement accounts to invest in alternative assets. As far as Entrust, we've been in business since 1981. We currently hold about $5 billion in assets. We've had over 45,000 investors that have used Entrust to provide custodial record keeping services for their IRA. And the way we differentiate ourselves, the main way we differentiate ourselves from our major competitors, is we provide you a single point of contact. So I'm one of four business development managers with Entrust, and we each have an associate. So if you have an account with Entrust, you are assigned one team of business development managers and their associates to be your point of contact. So if you have any questions, need any assistance, you're not just calling an 800 number or going to a general client services desk, you get your single point of contact to help you. We are custodians and record keepers of what are called self-directed retirement accounts, which are essentially IRAs, 401ks, in which you can hold non-traditional investments. The majority of our staff are certified IRA service professionals. We have these monthly webinars where sometimes we bring on subject matter experts, such as this one, where we have Neil on for about the seventh or eighth year in a row. And then we also have an annual IRA Academy where we provide training for other people in our space, in the retirement account space, to help them pass the certified IRA service professional designation. And that's it for me. I'm going to take off my Zoom, and I'm going to let Neil take over from here, and then I'll be back on whenever we get to the Q&A portion. So thanks for everybody for joining, Neil. It's your show.
Thank you. Thank you. So welcome everyone to Real Estate Trends 2024. This is a data-driven, chart-heavy collection of many eye-popping insights, and the goal is to help you make high-quality investment decisions in a very high-interest rate environment and potentially focus you on some brand new opportunities that this real estate recession has created. We are data scientists, and we look at today's real estate markets with a mixture of amusement and surprise, and you're about to find out why. So we are slowly recovering from whiplash because 2021 was the single most profitable year in real estate history. Best for single family, best for multifamily, best for commercial real estate. And from those heights, we came to 2022 and 2023, and everything changed in those 2 years. And so now we live in a new normal that is a model for reality in real estate. And in 2024, we see an enormous disconnect between mindset of investors and the opportunities that are available in the market space because of what's happened in the last 24 months. And our jobs today is to talk about risk and opportunities and sort of tie it all together with the U.S. economy for single-family real estate and also for multifamily real estate. And we'll start by looking at 2023, and then we'll take a look at the future. So our economic forecast for 2024 is going to cover it all, you know, GDP, recession, interest rates, unemployment, inflation. And then we're going to show you what is how real estate is likely to perform in this environment. And we'll finish with the shootout. So for the ninth year in a row, we will share analysts' picks for best cities and states in the US for real estate investing. And then at the end, I'm going to stick out my neck and give you my top pick for best city in the US to invest in. For those of you that don't know me well, I'm a quirky, rather opinionated data scientist, technologist. I either buy or I build large projects, 31 projects, about $1 billion. And there's about 1,000 very data-driven, very somewhat nerdy investors that trust us with their money. My mission in life has been to contribute to my adopted country. I came here from India. And what I found was the best way to do so, based on my skill set after I got out of my technology career, was to add stock to the United States. And I add stock to the US by taking old buildings and improving them so that, because otherwise they would basically become Class D areas with gunshots and things like that. So I improve buildings or I build buildings. And both ways I add to the United States stock and makes me feel like I'm contributing to meaningfully to the US economy. And these are for-profit projects. Our investors are pretty happy with the type of projects that we do. We don't discuss any sort of returns or information like that. All I can say is we've got very happy investors. I'll jump past this. Couple things. I'm not an investment advisor. So this seminar is for educational purposes only, and understand that all investments involve different degrees of risk. So be aware of your risk tolerance level, especially with IRA money. So you're free to accept or reject any recommendations made by us. Any recommendation I make today is not a guarantee for successful performance. So don't invest your money on our recommendation alone. Do consult a professional advisor. All right, let's get started. Well, 2023 is it's going to be a hard year to top. We call 2023 the last leg on the long road back to a normal real estate market in a normal economy, because 2019 was actually the last normal year. Every year since then has been bizarre in some way, and 2023 was actually no exception to that rule. Because in fact, in 2023, the US economy might have just done the impossible. Despite astonishingly high interest rates and lots of quantitative tightening by the Federal Reserve, the economy actually beat everyone's predictions, including our own. And that cartoon that you see on the left is actually a true representation of the economy. It basically barreled through all of our bearish warnings, all of our bearish projections. Unemployment remained extremely low. Inflation came down very smoothly. Energy prices dropped, Ukraine war or no Ukraine war. By the end of the year, we actually see no evidence at this point of any supply chain issues anywhere in the world. And I hope I get to say this again in the future, but the US economy really crushed it in 2023, absolutely crushed it. So in 2023, the US economy led the developed world, right? And for 2024 GDP, we're actually looking to grow faster than any other developed economy in the world. On the right, you can see that Goldman Sachs is predicting that, you know, this is going to happen in 2024. Goldman even predicts that lagging sectors of the economy, like manufacturing, will recover in 2024. So very surprising. Good surprise. Now, the slowdown in inflation was evident everywhere in the economy, even in healthcare. So you see, while healthcare premiums rose by about 7 or 8%, overall healthcare costs were down 1%, something that I have never seen happen before, and I don't think I'll ever see happen again. Oil was cheaper in 2023, and oil is a key component of everything we make and everything we grow, right? And because of that, everything else that you see on the screen was a lot cheaper. It may not seem that way, but that's why analysts like me bring this data to you. Because, you know, smartphones were 15% cheaper. Maybe not the flagship Apple phone, but they were all somewhat cheaper. And cars were down by 12%. That's a shocking number, but then they'd gone up at about 10% because of supply chain issues. So really what has happened is they went up and they came back down. So we're sort of close to the plateau where we were a while back. Let's take a look to see if this war on inflation that the Fed has launched is effectively over. And the answer is, it may not be over, but we're getting to the end zone here. So June 2022, which was about 19, 20 months ago, the inflation was at 9.1%. And there's actually two different ways in which we measure inflation. So the dark blue line and the dotted blue line. The dotted blue line doesn't include food and energy, because food and energy tend to be very volatile. You know, like a war starts somewhere in the world and all of a sudden energy gets more expensive, because of which food gets more expensive. So it's very volatile. So it's useful to look at both of these different measures, right? And you know, so it peaked at over 9%, and you know, it's at 3.1% according to this graph today. Actually, inflation numbers are coming in later in the day today, so we'll see. But I'm fully expecting that this 3.1 number is going to be in the twos for the first time in almost 2.5 years. So very excited about that. Now, on the right side, you see a measure of inflation called CPI, and you notice that in November it was down to 0.1% for a month. Right? Obviously, you have to multiply that by 12 months. But that's 1.2%. Now, I'm not suggesting inflation's at 1.2%, but I'm suggesting that it could be on the way to 1 to 1.5%. It's continuing to fall. And so today, our expectation is that inflation in 2024 is going to be only slightly above normal. You see that dotted red line? That's really where the Fed wants inflation to be. They never want it to be lower than that. They want it to be about that 2% level. And so you can see that we're expecting to be at 2.3%. And this could have been a lot worse, folks. It could have been a lot worse. And why do we care about inflation as potential real estate investors? And that's because high inflation is tied to high interest rates. And those interest rates are influenced by 10-year treasury rates that the Federal Reserve influences, moves up and down. And I'm really, really happy as a real estate investor to see this graph. Because on October 17th last year, that was the peak of everything, basically, that just remember that date. The 10-year treasury hit 5%. That is a stunningly high number. But today, it's around 4%, right? So the chart says 3.99. It's actually right around the 4% mark. So as you can see, even though from October 17 to now, the Fed hasn't dropped rates, they haven't played with the rates at all, we're already seeing a decline in interest rates that all of us pay in the market, in this case, you know, get for treasuries. But then we don't pay treasury rates when we buy single-family homes or multifamily homes. So it's really important to look at actual mortgage numbers in the marketplace. And once again, here you can see that the 30-year mortgage rate peaked around that October 17th date last year at 7.79%. That's a stunning number. And now it's correcting in our favor, right? So you can see where it is today. So it's already dropped by more than 1%. And here you can see the chief economist at Freddie Mac, a guy named Sam Cater, he points out that these lower rates are now potentially pulling, you know, potential home buyers off the sidelines and back into the market. And we're seeing increasing activity there. But then I don't think that these potential home buyers, they're going to jump into the market unless they feel comfortable about not just inflation, but also about wage growth, salaries, right? So after all, wage growth is how Americans, they measure their net worth and their feeling about whether they should buy expensive things. And for nearly 3 years, the chart shows that inflation was higher than wage growth, right? Which is bad, right? You don't want that happening at all. So now things are beginning to reverse. So that's the better part of the trend. That's the trend that you should be really looking at. Salaries are now growing faster than inflation. And that makes Americans feel good about themselves. They start buying homes and cars at a faster rate. In fact, most people would be shocked to know that wage growth as of July 2023 was over 5%. Well, that's something that very rarely happens in the US economy. So wage growth is cooling now, and we'll see some of that data in the next section. And that next section is the 2024 economic forecast. This is both me and a bunch of analysts sort of sticking out their neck and saying, here's what we think is going to happen this year for the economy. I'm going to move this poll out of the way. Oops. So our first prediction is about the economy itself. We were wrong last year. I was wrong last year. We thought a recession was inevitable, and based on the very strong evidence that we see now, we have to change our mind. We think that the US economy is going to have a soft landing this year, even though the second half of this year might feel closer to a recession. This on the screen is Marcus and Millichap's prediction, but a lot of the predictions that we've studied, by the way, are fairly close to this one, so it's pretty representative. So yes on soft landing, that is our first prediction today. And a lot of economists are actually saying things similar to what Freddie Mac is saying on this slide. And as you can see, Sarah Hoffman says that the economy is on track for a soft landing, but will be bumpy throughout the year. Now, because she's a multifamily person, her prediction on multifamily is about additional strain from new supply. I'm going to talk about that, and also high interest rates. But she does expect multifamily to retain its numero uno status as a favorable asset class. Now, our second prediction is about the labor market. The Fed's doing their job, and every single month we see job openings going down from their peak right here, about 12 million, to about 9 million jobs that are open as of today. And as you can see from the chart on the right, as job openings drop, so does wage growth, right? You know, because there's less competition in the marketplace, so employers have to pay less. So this number is still pretty healthy at 3.2% wage growth. So it's above current inflation, which is always good. But we do expect that wage growth will continue to cool. And that's why we think inflation is going to cool. As wages go down, people's ability to pay goes down. That tends to bring inflation down further. Now, our third prediction is about unemployment rate. Once again, we have to eat humble crow on this one because our prediction a year ago in this presentation was that the unemployment rate would be over 4%, so about 4.5% by the end of 2023. And as you can see from this red section on the left, it went up, right? But it went up really, really slowly. So analysts now expect that this slow trend is going to continue throughout 2024. And so they're expecting unemployment to end 2024 at 4.3%. By historical levels, still an extremely low level of unemployment. So expect unemployment to then start trending downwards at the end of 2024 and start basically trend downwards throughout 2025 and end 2025 at under 4%, unless we have some kind of COVID-like event. So that's where we stand. This is from the conference board, but we completely agree that this is what is likely to happen. Now, our fourth prediction is about the growth of the economy. This is commonly referred to as GDP. And as you can see from the section on the left in red, growth sort of did almost impossible things, accelerating throughout pretty much the entire year, where we were expecting it to decelerate throughout the year. Now, the analysts do expect that the economy will slow down quite a bit in 2024, with this portion here, that's the second half of this year, feeling like a recession. Not a recession, but feeling like a recession. And then they expect the economy to accelerate throughout the year next year in 2025. So our fifth and final prediction is about where interest rates are going. Now, as you can see, the analysts are sort of all over the map when it comes to rate cuts. The average seems to be around 130 basis points, so a 1.3% rate cut this year. We don't agree. We think the market is overly bullish. We think the Fed's more patient than the market. So we think rates are going to decline by 100 basis points or 1% by the end of this year. All right. So we're done with the dense economic analysis stuff. And now I'm going to get into something that's more interesting. A lot of people interested in it, and that's real estate. I'll start with a quick 2023 flashback, and then I'll get to the business of forecasting single family and multifamily performance in 2024. And let's start this real estate journey with single family home prices. I always like to look at single family first because single family is a much larger market than multifamily. And single family prices, they affect multifamily rents more than anything else. And single family in the US is in a bubble, but this is one resilient bubble. All predictions that single family prices will decline a bit in 2023 turned out to be wrong, completely wrong. Big dogs such as CoStar predicted a 20% decline, but home prices actually went up by a couple percent over the last year. In the last year. So now, why do I consider single family to be a bubble when home prices are going up? Well, for that, you just have to look at the three numbers on the right. This one, monthly mortgage payments have risen a shocking 111% since COVID. I want to point out that salaries have gone up by less than 20% in that time frame. Mortgage payments up 111%. Now, of this number, about 38% came from price increases. So the prices of property went up. The rest of it came from increases in interest rates. Almost a 4% increase in interest rates, more than double. Now you tell me, with numbers like that, completely out of whack with salaries, why shouldn't home prices go down? Well, they're not going down because it's a bubble and it's a very resilient bubble. And I know there's a lot of single family fanboys in this audience. They're thinking, Neil, you're wrong because interest rates are going to be much lower in 2024. So home prices will be fine. It's not in a bubble. Okay, fine. But let's look at mortgage rate predictions for 2024. Come on. There we go. These don't look like low rates to me, right? Even if we pick the most bullish projection on this page, right, in green on the left from the Mortgage Bankers Association, rates are going to be no lower than 6.1% for the year. Well, that's not much lower than 6.7% today, right? Mortgage rates are highly predictive in nature. So the Federal Reserve doesn't actually need to cut interest rates for mortgage rates to go down. So we think that half of the reduction in mortgage rates, it's already happened over the last 4 or 5 months. So these numbers should be pretty spot on. These are high interest rates, right? They should be poking that bubble and breaking it. But they're not, because despite those astonishingly high interest rates, almost nobody this year is predicting a decline in home prices. Last year, almost everyone was predicting a decline. There were a few people that were bullish. Everyone's extremely bullish this year. And even the two red bars on the page, you see them on the left, realtor.com and Zillow, they barely move the needle on home prices. Zillow's saying minus 0.2%. That's really flat, right? And their reasoning is, well, we've got low unemployment, we got high wage growth, we got more than 9 million jobs open in the US, so we're not going to predict that a housing bubble is going to burst this year. And all why it's not going to burst is not because of the low unemployment or the high wage growth. It's because of the lock-in effect. So let's study this effect, the lock-in effect. So let's say you're a homeowner and you purchased your home 5 or 6 years ago, and now it's been appreciating every single year, it goes up. And right now it's worth about $1.2 million on the left, right? And you've got about $350,000 in home equity built up. So in 2021, you decided to refinance. Yay, good for you, got a great rate, 3%. And that put your monthly mortgage payment right around $3,600 principal and interest. But then you find out that your wife is pregnant and you're going to need an extra bedroom. So you go check out properties today and you see homes with that extra bedroom are today 1.5 million. So you crunch numbers, right? And you're like, yeah, I've got 350K in equity, right? That I can take from the sale of the current property and I can apply it to the down payment of the new one. But with rates around 6.6%, you'll realize that even with that 350K in equity buildup, your new principal interest payment is $7,600. So despite that equity buildup, your new monthly payment is $4,000 a month higher. That's nuts. Who can afford that? And this is the reason why you're going to see a lot of homeowners having to stay put because the payments just don't make sense anymore. And that lock-in effect means that the housing bubble will not burst, at least not this year, and may not even deflate for a significant number of years. And that is leading to the next disruptive real estate trend. It's leading to forever renters. It used to be that two-thirds of all Americans lived in their own homes, and about one-third lived in a rental property. But with those astonishingly high prices and mortgage prices and that lock-in effect, we're now seeing middle-class Americans become forever renters. Now, as you can see from this graph, buyers must now earn $115,000 a year to afford a typical home in the United States. And that typical buyer only makes about $75,000, probably up to a little above $80,000 now because that's a 2022 number. So that gap of $35,000 is almost impossible to bridge in the near term. And remember that number, the 115K number that I just gave you is for the entire United States. Let's look at some of the cities that have good job prospects, and we'll see what the numbers are in those cities. In San Francisco, you need a median income of $404,000 a year to afford a home. And even though San Francisco prices have gone down this year, the doubling of mortgage rates means that this 404K number has actually increased by nearly $100,000 in just the last 12 months. Now, in case you're thinking, why would I go live in San Francisco when I can go to Phoenix? Well, Phoenix isn't cheap anymore. Phoenix over $100,000 in income. Dallas is at $116,000. Miami, $145,000. Nashville, $124,000. In fact, the only large metros that are near $100,000 anymore are Houston at $92,000 and Atlanta at $107,000. And that's what is driving people to third-tier cities. We're now seeing people move from Nashville to Knoxville, to Chattanooga, even to Memphis. People are moving from Phoenix to Tucson and moving from Tucson to Flagstaff. So as technology allows it, smaller and smaller metros are taking a bigger and bigger share of the jobs, and this migration in smaller cities is going to continue to accelerate. Disruptive real estate trend. That's our biggest takeaway from this presentation. And here's an example of how this move, this disruptive move to smaller metros, is changing the winners and losers in the United States. The bigger winner, biggest winner since COVID in term of state, you'd think would be Arizona, Texas, Florida, the cheap markets. Well, would you shock you to learn that Texas is no longer in the top 10 since COVID? Because the taxes are not, Texan markets are not cheap anymore, right? Dallas, 115K in income. Houston, 92K. Austin, stratospheric, 126K. Texas is no longer ultra hot for home price growth, though it remains the top market in the nation for people to move to. Now we are seeing new winners, states like Montana, Idaho, North Carolina, Tennessee. These are the states we're watching when we're looking at creating profits for our investors. All right. So hopefully that was a good roundup of the single family market in the United States and all the disruptive trends that are changing at that market. Now let's take a look at multifamily apartments. What's happening in the multifamily market space? Well, oddly enough, and I rarely say this, the multifamily market is actually in an incredibly balanced place. Now, I don't say that, but I want to show you some fantastically interesting numbers, right? Most people at conferences, when I say this, you know, they stand up and say multifamily is still too expensive, and they're probably right. But you know what a renter cares about most? They care about rents, right? And here, the multifamily market has shown an astonishing level of balance. I want you to look at the top two numbers on the right in green. Rents in the United States increased roughly 19.6% since COVID. In the last year, it was only about 1%, by the way. Now, how have wages in the United States increased by 19.7%? You notice that rents are going up exactly the same speed as wages. And there's no better example of the balance in the multifamily market than those two numbers. Since COVID, multifamily rents have increased by $385. Mortgages have increased by a stunning $1,140. That's three times as much as rent. Don't believe me? Just move your eyes back to the left, and you can see single-family mortgages starting at 1023 when COVID hit to 2162 in late 2023. So balance is the good news, but there's bad news in the multifamily market. There is massive, massive incoming supply, and over 3,000 multifamily market properties are in distress. So let's dig into those. First, the incoming supply of new apartments. It is stunningly high. Not since this dude was president in the 70s has America seen as many apartments coming online in a single year as we are going to see this year, 2024, right? So RealPage predicts that there are going to be 672,000 apartments delivered this year. That's an absolutely crazy number. And it's definitely more than we can absorb in a single year. Now, it's very important to understand that the vast majority of supply is in Sunbelt markets like Austin, Raleigh, and Nashville, Jacksonville, Charlotte. These are the markets that are likely to be more impacted in 2024, not the national market. Now, some of you may be wondering, but Neil, isn't there also a slowdown in the single family construction market? Wouldn't that help with the multifamily absorption? The short answer is no. You know, a lot of analysts made predictions that we might see shocking, stunning drops in single family new construction. Well, none of that happened. The economy stayed strong. So the large builders, they've not seen significant declines in their prices, though they've seen a big increase in incentives. They're pushing, you know, using heavy incentives to push their sales. You can see from the graph here, they're currently scheduled to build almost a million homes, right, in 976K in 2024. So we're not seeing a very significant decline in new construction on the single family side. So that's really unlikely to help the multifamily market. What's important to note is that this new supply is not spread around the US very smoothly. The Sun Belt, and that's down here, the yellow color, has a very significant amount of inventory coming in, 3% of total inventory. So it's projected that Sun Belt markets will see negative or flat rent growth, depending on the market. But you can clearly see the Northeast, which is in green, has only 1.3% incoming inventory. So it's expected to have good, strong rent growth for those of you that are buying apartments there. A lot of the Midwest and Rust Belt states are similar, where the inventory growth is only about 1.5%. So rent growth should be strong for those of you looking to invest in, Midwest markets, especially in Ohio. The West is really the only market where rent growth still expected to be negative, even though the inventory is low that's coming in. Why? Because the West is suffering a great deal from interest rates because it has the highest prices in the country. So it's more sensitive to high interest rates than some of the cheaper markets. All right. Now let's look at some of the from the some of these rent growth projections. So many of you are landlords, so you want to know, where rent growth is going to be in the US. Well, I'll show you two numbers, or three numbers actually, from going from bearish to bullish. Here's the bullish one. Yardi Matrix thinks rent growth in 2024 is under 1%. They do point out here in this blue section that once supply is absorbed, and they don't expect that to happen this year, they expect it to happen next year, we expect to see 3 to 4% rent growth. CoStar, which is the other analyst that talks about rent growth in the United States, is a bit more bullish, balanced, but bullish. They're saying, well, there's a lot of supply coming in, rent growth under 1%, under 1%, but then you start to see acceleration happen, right? So they're agreeing with the RD on the first two quarters of the year, but they're saying, no. We think rent growth is going to start accelerating the second half of this year, as opposed to Yardi, who thinks we'll have to wait until 2025. So fairly balanced, but decent rent growth accelerating throughout the year as some of that inventory gets absorbed. And then you've got the bearish folks. This is Marker. They're even more aggressive. They're projecting that 2024 rent growth is going to be 4%. Just for those of you that are new to rents and being landlording, 2% rent growth is great. It's fine. That's what we look for. 3%, we're very happy. 4%, we're dancing naked on the street with a champagne bottle. So if Marker's right, 2024 is going to be a great year. I think they're going to be wrong. CoStar's more likely to be right, and we might be somewhere in the 2% range. What's interesting is that Freddie Mac, which is the second largest lender in the United States, expects that income growth will be strong in places like Oklahoma, with both Oklahoma City and Tulsa in the top three. Never happens. Never seen it in the last 10 years, right? On the right side, the city with all the big construction pipelines, Nashville, Austin, DC, New York, they will all have higher vacancy and almost no rent growth at all, right? So this is really about, the rest of America having a pretty decent year and then high growth markets having a tough year. All right, done with rents. Now let's finish the multifamily section with something that you might have heard of recently with lots of clickbait, lots of articles. Distress, right? So this is the sword that's looming all over our heads. And let me just start by saying, yes, there's distress in multifamily. A lot of you have read clickbait articles on the web about $1 trillion of multifamily debt needing to mature. But what most people don't tell you is that trillion-dollar number is by 2028. And that number offers zero indication of the percentage of the assets that might face any level of distress or any level of discomfort when they refinance. That's just the base number, right? But they're using it to scare you to click on the article. When I appear on podcasts, I've done about 300 of them, I do some mental math and I mentioned that I think that the total amount of distress is about $90 billion, right? Data from Bloomberg, which you see on this slide on the right side, mentions about $67 billion of potential distress, right? Now, keep in mind that this is a very small portion of the overall multifamily market. That market is over $4 trillion in total assets. So we're talking about 1.5%. Now, on the left, you can see that it's not just apartments, but all kinds of assets in commercial real estate that could be in distress. But it's very important to distinguish the black bars from the blue bars. For example, you notice that the black bar for office shows $35 billion of assets currently in distress and about $50 billion that could potentially be in distress. But the apartment black bar, it's much smaller than office. It's only $8 billion. But there's a lot of assets that could be potentially distressed if the Fed doesn't, drop interest rates. Industrial, almost no current distress, but a potential for $26 billion. So bottom line is that there's still a lot of potential for distress, but very little real distress, with the exception of office, where there's massive amounts of distress. Somehow, though, because of all the clickbait on the web, there's this irrational, somewhat nonsensical belief that there's already a large amount of multifamily distress, right? People are saying, oh, there's distress in the multifamily market. That's just BS. Here you can see the actual delinquency rate by loan category as of the end of Q3 last year. As you can see, the big bars in delinquency are credit cards, auto loans, home equity loans, and then followed by delinquency in single family homes. Where in this graph is multifamily? It's actually all the way to the bottom. So as of the end of Q3 last year, only 0.4% of all multifamily assets were delinquent. That's it. 0.4%. That's not even 0.5%. Will it increase? Yes. But will it increase anywhere near the levels that you see at the top of the chart? There is no conceivable scenario that we know of in which that happens. Now, even when some of that happens, some of that distress, inevitable distress, it's going to be restricted to certain markets. That green bars shows that most markets in the US don't have much distress. The two peaks that you see, one here and one here, are Washington, DC and San Francisco. Overall, the markets that are most exposed are on the far right. So you see New York, Dallas, Atlanta, Los Angeles, Austin, and San Francisco. If you're not investing in these markets, you're probably not going to notice any large amount of distress. Bloomberg's list of cities, it's slightly different from the list I just gave you. They think it's New York, Los Angeles, Chicago, Dallas, and Houston that are the top five cities that are going to see distress. Now, once again, I want you to look carefully at the blue bars to notice that even in these massive mega cities, the total number of distressed assets is in the low hundreds, not in the high thousands that you've been led to believe, right? So here, New York, you're looking at maybe 400 assets total, even though New York has hundreds of thousands of apartment complexes. Now, what that stress is likely to do is to lower the prices of multifamily further. We've seen price reductions of about 20% so far, with some cities being as high as 30, some being as low as 10. It depends on the asset type, depends on the market. And we expect prices to go down by another 5 to 7%. So we could end this, we could hit the bottom sometime at the end of this year at 27% from peak. Why? Because there's new supply coming in, 671,000 units, and these distressed assets need to start selling throughout this year. So let me read this statement that I highly resonate with. This is Spencer Gray from Gray Capital, and he says, while the next 6 to 12 months are still uncertain, I can imagine a scenario where we witness some real distress all at once, which will create a lot of fear. That may create a window where some incredible assets can be acquired at a significant discount from the previous market prices. He said this a number of months ago, and that's exactly what we're seeing. Any distress will be short, agreed, with interest rates gradually going down and the base case for multifamily being as strong as ever. So to us, this is, often we've said this is a great time to buy single family. Unfortunately, this is not one of those years. There is no decline in single family prices. They remain in a bubble. The bubble is unlikely to burst, but we're also unlikely to see increases in single family beyond maybe 1 to 2% mark. Multifamily, on the other hand, has declined by a minimum of 20%, well, an average of 20%, but many markets are higher than that. This may be a good time to buy, especially if you can find those rare assets that have assumable loans, meaning, if somebody's got a 3% loan, got locked in 2022, it's locked in for 10 years. Well, when you buy their asset, don't get a new loan, basically assume their loan. So you get the discounts that the high interest rates have caused, but you don't get to deal with the high interest rates as one. So the number two trend is almost everyone buying today is looking for assumable loans so that they can avoid the distress but benefit from the discounts. All right, we'll finish off with the shootout. So the you know we I basically you know well I'll go past this and start the shootout process. And this, I want to warn you, is the most confusing list, best cities list that I've ever presented. Bill's been watching this for about 7 or 8 years. But before I do that, I want to talk about my mission. My life mission has become to address those people that have absolutely no chance of buying a home. I showed you in this presentation a very, very key graph. And that graph basically is this one. People can't buy homes in the US unless they make over $100,000. And in most cities, people are making less than $100,000. So those people are forced to live in apartments. So I've made it my life mission to build 10,000 rental townhomes for those people because they don't want to live in apartments. They have dogs, they have kids, they want to have a backyard, they want to have a garage. So that is my mission to build 10,000 townhomes. And I encourage you to join my mission in various ways, even if it is as an evangelist. I need help. This is a very big mission, and I will need many different kinds of supports. If this resonates with you, it's designed for that middle America that we are abandoning, and certainly our politicians are abandoning. So if you'd like to join that, feel free to put that into the chat and just type in the word Mission 10K, and I'll give you more information about Mission 10K in the future. I feel like this is where I have to spend the next 10 years of my life. And if I could contribute 10,000 rental townhomes, that would be a life well served. All right, let's finish off. Shootouts. I always like to start with the U-Haul list that shows the high growth states. So in 2023, Texas and Florida retained their number one and number two ranks, respectively, for the states with the highest number of people that are moving to. Number three and four were also similar compared to 2022, with North Carolina moving up a spot, South Carolina moving down a spot, Tennessee's moving up, Idaho's moving down a bit. New entry on the charts with Washington State moving up from 23rd to 7th. Otherwise, Arizona and Colorado, right where they are a year ago. The biggest losers continue to be the same states, the state of Massachusetts and California. Note that the California has now been the biggest loser 4 years running. Now, it is important to note that even though Texas is number one on the list, its price growth in multifamily is outside the top 10 because Texas is becoming a more expensive state. So keep that in mind. All right, done with states. Let's move on to list of top cities. And never in my life did I think I would ever see a city in Ohio at the top of a top 10 housing markets list. Ohio is a perennial slow-moving state. And never in my life did I think that I would see a list that didn't have a single city in the Southeast. So Realtor.com's top 10 housing market list is all about the Midwest, the Northeast, and some of the cheaper cities in the West, such as Riverside and Bakersfield. So the trend is clear. The hot boom towns are, for the moment, not doing well because of high interest rates. So let's balance out that list. That was a little slightly radical with a second list from Zillow. And once again, the state of Ohio rules. Number two, number three, number eight on the list. They are the top three cities in Ohio, highly affordable. Zillow has a more balanced approach. So you do see some of the boom towns, Atlanta, Charlotte, Orlando, Tampa. So those are boom towns that are presented in the list. It's also very nice to see Indianapolis in the list. I've picked this city in the past, and it's doing really well and moving upwards. One final list, and this one's from Realtor Magazine, and it's published by the National Association of Realtors. They give the nod to Atlanta as the best housing market among small markets. Note, there's some interesting ones that are in here, like Greenville, South Carolina, not Greenville, Grand Rapids, Michigan, Myrtle Beach, South Carolina. So these are some very, very interesting markets to look at. There is one more. This is sort of an odd top list, right? So Marker is looking for cities that they think is the next Austin. Austin has been sort of one of the biggest real estate opportunities of the last 10 years. And so they analyze all kinds of metrics, population, education, growth of tech workers, salaried workers. And their top five are Raleigh-Durham, a city that we picked in 2020 as our city of the year. Provo, Utah, a city that we picked in 2016 and 17. The first time Bill Neville watched this presentation, the city picked was Provo, Utah. Madison, small city. Kansas City, very, very happy to see Kansas City. We picked it in 2021. And Colorado Springs. So these are the five cities that could become potentially the next Austin. All right, done with the presentation. Time for me to stick out my neck and make two predictions. So I pick the best up-and-coming market in the US, and those are usually smaller markets. And then I pick what I consider to be the best market for real estate investment in 2024. And the best up-and-coming market is Grand Rapids, Michigan. When we did this presentation for Entrust last year, we mentioned Grand Rapids as a near miss, so it lost this category to Jacksonville. And this year, it gets its time in the pipeline. So very affordable, very vibrant downtown. It's got really interesting neighborhoods, very lively business districts. So when I look at this, it's amazing. And what's shocking is that even though home prices only went up by 1 or 2%. Grand Rapids home prices went up 12.8% by the end of December last year. And here is our last slide. The best market in the United States, according to us, is Raleigh, Durham, North Carolina. This is 2020's joint winner with Charlotte. So it returns. This time it's on its own. And really, what differentiates Raleigh from so many other boom towns that are suffering this year is the exceptional quality of talent. So it's got three world-class universities. They anchor this market. It's got continued demand for talent. It means that even though they have huge incoming supply, they're continuing to see rents rise this year. So they outperformed all of the other boom towns. Rent growth will slow in 2024. There's a lot more supply coming in, but you don't go into a market for 1 year. You go in for 5 years, and we agree with Marker, this market could be the new Austin. So that's our presentation. And we talked about six or seven disruptive real estate trends. We do 20 knowledge-packed webinars each year at multifamilyu.com. They're free. There's no subscription. There's no upsell. It's just a place where people get together and do a bunch of different webinars. So check out multifamilyu.com. And if you'd like to know more about my life mission, type in Mission 10K into the chat. And that's it. Back to Bill.
Okay,
All right.
thanks. If you want to skip ahead a slide or two, skip ahead to the next slide.
Okay.
If you want to invest in real estate or any other thing in a self-directed IRA, you can do that with us. Just open an account, fund your account, and purchase your investment. We've got another webinar coming up next month on expanding your IRA strategy. We're going to have a roundtable on that. And we have some survey questions you can answer after this. So please, we'd appreciate it if you could give us those feedbacks. If you have any more information on self-directed IRAs, you can go to the Learning Center on our website or follow us on social media. Okay, question and answer. Go ahead to the next slide after this one. I think it has our contact info. Yeah, so just leave that up. So there's my contact, there's Neil's. All right. Let's start going through these questions. So the first question, Neil, just simply says, what about all the non-recourse commercial loans coming due?
There are a ton of loans coming due, but what you have to understand is that simply because there are loans coming due in one sector, it doesn't necessarily affect another sector. So here's a perfect example. I told you multifamily prices have dropped by 20%. Well, hotels have only dropped by 7%, and storage has only dropped by 1 or 2%. These are commercial sectors. So when multifamily, the darling, dropped by 20% in a single year, why didn't industrial drop by more than 1%? Why didn't storage drop by more than 3%? What about hotels at 7%? The answer is that each of these follow their own path. Each of these look at supply and demand uniquely. I would say this to you because I think that's what you're trying to imply. The biggest risk of these loans that are coming due, right, recourse or non-recourse loans that are coming due, is simply in the office sector. I think that we are in for a 10-year apocalypse in the office sector, but I'm not sure what impact that will have on other aspects of commercial real estate. I do see people that used to buy offices now buying multifamily. So I guess there's a positive impact along with a negative impact. But these things happen. There's properties in distress at all points in the US. And I think you're going to hear a lot more about office. You'll hear some about multifamily this year because there's still some distress there. But I think by 2025, we'll be in a good place. Keep in mind, multifamily is at 94.6%, 94.4% occupancy. Offices are now in the low 80s, and places like San Francisco are in the low 70s. So it's an existential crisis for them.
Okay, next questions. This one's for me. If I hold a property in a self-directed IRA and it is in a different state than where I live, would I be required to file a tax return in the state where the property is located when the property is sold? If you hold an asset inside an IRA and you sell that property or sell that investment, whether it's a property or whether it's stock, all that revenue from the sale gets paid directly to the IRA. So there are no taxes that are filed. You simply grew your retirement account. So it doesn't matter what the state the property is held in. The fact that it's held inside an IRA and it's sold by the IRA. The revenue gets paid to the IRA. There's no tax consequences associated with that. When you take a withdrawal from your IRA, at that point, you have to pay taxes on the distribution you take, unless it's a Roth IRA, those grow tax-free. Okay, Neil, what's your opinion on investing in lower cost housing units in markets like Milwaukee?
I'm generally, I want to caution you that these lower house cost housing markets like Milwaukee, they're lower cost for a reason. So I have wasted a lot of my money in markets like Milwaukee and Chicago. And I can tell you this, that when you see a home for 60 or 70,000 or 80,000, the first thing you need to be thinking is, what are going to be the expenses? My uniform experience, bar none, has been that the expenses in these markets are extremely high, especially snow markets, because there's a lot of snow removal. There's a lot of damage that happens because of the snow. Pipes freeze up, they burst. In general, and I'm talking about a significant number of people that I've polled, the profits in these cheap states are much lower than the average profits in states that are a bit warmer. Having said that, I think there are exceptions to that rule. I think Indianapolis and Kansas may be two areas that you might want to look at, and so is Columbus, Ohio.
Neil, what is your projection about the desirability of BTR? Not sure where he's talking about there. And
Sure.
which are the best markets for the next 2 to 5 years?
Sure. Built to rent or BTR is a segment of multifamily that's extremely hot at this point. Why? Because remember, two-thirds of Americans used to live in their own home, one-third used to rent. And that one-third that used to rent used to have low incomes. Let's call it 55K or lower. But because of these charts that I showed you on the screen, now that people need $115,000 in income, we've now marooned, just since COVID in the last 3 years, we've marooned about 30 million Americans that want to live in a home. And so a new apartment asset class has been created and is growing called built to rent, which basically builds townhomes. Used to build single family homes for rent. It's too expensive. Nobody's doing it anymore. Now people are building townhomes for rent. So you get a little backyard, you get a little, you get one car garage. So not as good as a single family home, but better than an apartment for families. And so the projection on the desirability of BTR is extreme. At every conference, they're saying it's extreme, but there are challenges because construction costs are high, interest costs are high. So what we've done is basically we've analyzed all 323 markets in the US, and we've actually published the answer to your question, GS. We've published the answer to your question on our website, mission10k.com. Go down and you'll see a list of cities. So we've looked at those cities from the perspective of construction costs, from insurance and taxes, property taxes, and we basically figured out markets where BTR works, in a high interest rate environment. In a low interest rate environment, you can probably build it anywhere, but in a high interest rate environment, there's very few cities. They're all published at mission10k.com.
Next question. How do you find multifamily assets with assumable loans?
By making a lot of phone calls. So roughly 10% of all assets selling today are with assumable loans. So I'm not saying you have to do something radical like send text messages to a 10,000 people. I'm not suggesting anything like that. But if you had a large pipeline of projects, the projects that are selling in the open market, right? So these are not being hidden. Brokers are promoting them. If you had a pipeline of 100 multifamilies, 10 or possibly even 15 would have assumable loans. It's not the most difficult thing in the world. So the last properties, the two properties I purchased had 4% and 5% assumable loans, which obviously are much lower than the market, which is at about 6.5% right now.
Somebody asked, what is the minimum for the interest IRA? We don't have a minimum. We don't impose a minimum on you. You can open an account for any dollar amount. Bear in mind, we have a minimum annual fee that's $199 a year. So, depending upon the return on the investment that you're going to get, if you invest $1,000 and, we have a minimum fee of $199 a year, you'd need to get a pretty significant return on that $1,000 to make it worthwhile to hold an asset with us. So no, we don't have a minimum, but bear in mind that there is a fee associated with having an asset held with us. There's a question, Neil, and don't know how you would answer this, but isn't gold still a safer bet right now than real estate?
It is. Gold is not an investment. Gold is insurance. And by its very nature, things that are insurance tend to be safer bets. You didn't ask me whether the gold is a better bet than real estate. You asked me if it's a safer bet. So I'm going to say, yes, gold is a safer bet than real estate. Is it a better returns generator? I don't think so.
Are there significant demographics that will impact on demand of San, it says SF or
Single
other
family, single
single
family.
family or multifamily real estate markets?
Yes, there are. So the United States population growth is slowing, and that population growth slowdown, we're basically at 0.5% population growth for last year. Obviously, the COVID years were weird because of so many deaths, but we're at about 0.5% population growth. So our population growth is slowing. That has significant impact. But it doesn't have significant impact in the next 5 to 10 years because the people that either rent apartments or buy homes are generally adults in their 20s, 30s, and 40s. And that audience, those people came from 10 years, 20 years. They were born, 20 or 30 or 40 years ago when demographics were stronger. And so that population is still requiring homes because they're creating households. What does happen is by 2030, we start seeing that these lower numbers, the lower population growth that we've had for the last 10 or 15 years, start to affect us. So I would say in the 30s, we would see a significant, very significant slowdown in real estate demand because of population. But it takes a while to get to that point.
Okay, Neil, the question is, why did you do the analysis on mortgage payment increase on a $1.2 million example rather than US median of around 350K?
I could have done it on a US median home of around 350K. The percentages would have still been the same. I think my goal there was to kind of use some big numbers because they're a little more eye-popping, just trying to make my point. And on a 350K home, the difference might only seem like $1,000 instead of $4,000. But my point is, for people who live in those cheaper markets, the percentage difference, whether it's 1,000 or 4,000, is still mind-blowing. Your mortgage is still doubling at 350. It's doubling at 1.2 million. So I just use the bigger numbers just to get my point in. But the bottom line is, whether it's 350 or 1.2 million, your mortgage doubled.
Okay, the next question is, if you hold real estate in an IRA, when it comes time to take minimum distributions, how is that accomplished? So I assume your question is that you hold only real estate and you don't have any other like easily liquidated assets. And the answer to that is you can take a percentage of an existing asset as an in-kind distribution. Let me explain what I mean by that. So let's say you own a property worth $1 million, and that's your entire retirement account, and you're subject to RMD, and let's say your RMD is $40,000. You're allowed to take, so the title holder of that real estate, excuse me, with us would be the Entrust Group FBO for benefit of your name and account number. That's who owns that property. Let's say you decide you need to take a distribution. Well, you could take, let's say, 4% or $40,000 of value of that asset as a distribution. So what you do is you would request $40,000 of an in-kind distribution of the asset. So now $40,000 of value of that property would be distributed from the Entrust Group FBO, your name and account number, to your name. So you'd now have to go change title on that property to being owned 100% by the IRA to now owned 96% by the Entrust Group, FBO, et cetera, and 4% owned by you personally. So assuming that's some kind of rental property, as an example, that rent would now get paid 96% to your IRA, 4% to you property, or I'm sorry, 4% to you personally, right? Same with expenses. Expenses like property tax insurance that were previously being paid 100% by the IRA would now get paid 96% by you, 4% by the IRA, et cetera, et cetera. You could do that every year. We have actually had people who have used that as a strategy where they bought a property, let's say in a location that they want to retire to, and they bought that property when they were 55 years old, as an example, in their IRA. And took, well, 55 is probably not a good, let's say 60, because then you're past 59 and a half. And then for the next, let's say 10 years, they took 10% a year as a distribution until at age 70, they now own the property and then they move to it, right? It can be a strategy, but ultimately, to answer your question, Just because you don't have cash in your IRA doesn't mean you can't take a distribution. You can take an in-kind asset either as a whole distribution or a partial distribution. But you do have to change titling on that property, in this example, property on that asset. Each time you take a distribution, you're now changing percentage of who owns that property from entirely by your IRA to partially by your IRA and partially to you. You also have to have the cash in your, personal savings to pay the taxes on that distribution. So, talk to a CPA or somebody about that. But yeah, you're not like screwed if you don't have cash inside your IRA. You can take an in-kind asset as a distribution. All right, Neil, what do you think of Jacksonville, Florida in 2024?
The market has a very large amount of incoming inventory. We think it's a very strong market. So you may want to wait until the end of the year or the beginning of next year because that inventory is going to bring down prices further.
Okay, what are your thoughts regarding workforce housing, especially in Florida, given the new SB 102 Live Local Act?
That particular local act, I think, is beneficial for developers that are already there or operators that are already there. I don't think it's going to lead to a rush of developers, running to Florida. So the act is very interesting. It has significant benefits, but I think that what'll really happen is local developers will probably build a bit more.
Are you concerned with the lack of insurance available to states like Florida due to the risk of hurricanes for multifamily properties?
Everyone's worried about that because it's an X factor. We don't know how bad things are going to be in the coming years. So essentially, people that are buying properties in Florida, I buy some, I don't buy a lot, are allocating very, very large gaps or very, very large buffers for insurance. And hopefully the worst doesn't happen. But if it does, then yes, there's a potential for prices to go down in Florida.
What is your population floor for small metros when searching for opportunities?
I don't have one population floor. I have three when I'm not looking at mega metros. So the first floor is 150,000 people in a metro. City doesn't matter. You only have to look at metro. So a perfect example of a super small metro that I like that I've built in is Idaho Falls, Idaho, very fast growing metro. And then I look at 500,000 people. So good examples are Greenville, South Carolina, which is a little bit bigger than that, or the Northwest Arkansas cluster of cities like Rogers, 500,000 is a good number. Reno is actually a terrific market. It's about 450,000. So it really depends on your risk level, right? So if you want to take significant risk, you can go to the 150. The 500K is not as risky. And if you're very risk averse, then go in for a $1.5 million floor. So markets would be Columbus, Kansas City, Raleigh, North Carolina. So you get a bunch of cities that are still not superstar tier one, gateway cities, but there's a lot of cities in that 1.5 to 2 million range. Indianapolis is in that list as well.
Would you recommend buying an office building and converting it to an apartment building?
I'm really glad that people ask me this question because it seems to make common sense that this is something that you should do. And my answer is not no, it's hell no. Please do not attempt to do this. Almost everyone that will do it will fail for one simple reason. The basis of office on a square footage basis is here. The basis for what you would convert it to is here. Well, office would need to fall all the way down here for this to happen because it costs millions of dollars to basically rip out plumbing and do all kinds of stuff to convert an office into an apartment building. Offices are designed so that the restrooms are either in the middle or in one corner. Well, you have to basically now send piping all the way through for every single apartment. And it really doesn't work well because offices don't have enough windows. They're rectangular. Multifamily really needs to be, linear because every single bedroom needs to have a window. So what I can tell you is even people that know how to do this are afraid of doing it. In almost every case, there is no math that works. Don't do it.
If you had $200,000 to invest in a duplex with the goal of income generation, would you look to smaller markets and pay cash or buy in a medium to large market and assume a mortgage?
I would look to go into a smaller market, but not pay cash. Isn't the whole point of the smaller market that you have more cash flow? Well, if you have more cash flow, why would you be afraid of a mortgage? You might say, well, the mortgages are too high. Fine, in that case, take a shorter term mortgage, you know. But I think not using leverage doesn't make sense because the United States economy is designed to benefit from leverage. There are all sorts of tax benefits of leverage, and you're giving them up for no reason, in my opinion.
Population growth will probably go up to about 1% post-COVID and different immigration policies. Would you agree? Is there such thing as post-COVID? Or isn't just COVID
Yeah,
reality at this point?
it is, right? So we're in an endemic world. The short answer is I see no evidence that population growth is going to go back up to 1%. What you're talking about is radically different insurance policies. Have you seen the political climate? Not even the Democrats at this point are advocating for significantly higher immigration. Obviously, it's, most people that are not tied to any political party know that that's actually the best path for the US to grow, but I'm not in politics, so I'll just simply say that the chance that the US grows at 1% population growth in the next 20 years is extraordinarily low.
Does the built-to-rent strategy with townhomes work for existing townhomes that you buy and hold?
Most of the time, no, because the prices are too high. Those townhomes, basically, you're competing with people that could buy them, because one of the things you can do with townhomes that you can't do with apartments easily is you can, sell some, keep some. And because of that, you're also competing with the single family market, which, as you know, prices are extremely high. So in most cases, when you're buying them, you're paying too much. There's not enough cash flow. So buying existing townhomes for rent, buy and hold is a low cash flow strategy.
Is there a backlog of unmet demand for single family or multi-family properties due to many younger people delaying moving out and getting married, and from many potential buyers that could not buy in 2020 to 2023 but still want need to buy?
To some extent, yes, but keep in mind that we typically deliver about 400,000 units in a year, and we're delivering 671,000 this year. So that backlog is actually being met by increased construction. So it's being balanced out.
Do you have a slide comparing multifamily versus single family SFR, single family rental investing?
No, and I don't think it's possible to have a single slide. If you think about it, 25 slides of this presentation were a comparison. Bill's going to send you the entire deck. So I think that's much better than trying to cram all of it into a single slide.
Yeah, we should mention that that everybody we send this out to everybody who registered for the webinar. So there's actually people who don't attend that sign up just so they can watch it later. What's your opinion on the Dallas multifamily market?
Dallas is the best market in the United States. However, incoming supply is high. It's likely that prices will be negative this year, and so will rents. You may want to look at Q1 2025 to buy in to the best market in America.
What is your opinion about multifamily in Rhode Island this year and house hacking?
I have no opinions on either one of those. Unfortunately, I have to study major metros, and Rhode Island is, roughly the size of a penny.
All right, Neil, that was the last question. As always, it's a pleasure. Thanks for having us on here. Neil's going to be doing this again for his own group. So if you want to see him do it again, he's probably got it on his website there. Just send him an email and I'm sure he could send you the link. Neil, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for bringing your expertise on with us. And everybody, thank you for joining, and hope you open accounts with us if you don't have one already. Thanks.
Thanks so much, everyone. Bye-bye.